caves. Masawada rubbed her temples with the heels of her palms.
You are asking a lot in exchange for an uncertain reward, Aragorn.
The reward may be uncertain, he said, but our doom is inevitable unless we try.
Is it? I am not so sure. Still,
for an uncomfortably long time, Masawada was silent, gazing past the edge of the image. Then she nodded once, as if confirming something to herself, and said,
I can delay our arrival at Feinster for 2 or 3 days. There are several towns in the area we can seize first. Once we do reach the city, I can pass another 2 or 3 days having the Varden build siege engines and prepare fortifications. No one will think strangely of it. After that, though, I will have to set upon Feinster, if for no other reason but that we need their supplies. An army that sits still in enemy territory is an army that starves. At the most, I can give you 6 days, and perhaps only 4.
As she spoke, Aragorn made several quick calculations.
4 days won't be long enough, he said, and 6 might not be either. It took Saphira 3 days to fly to Farthen Dur, and that was without stopping to sleep and without having to carry my weight. If the maps I have seen are accurate, it's at least as far from here to Ellesmere, maybe farther, and about the same from Ellesmere to Feinster. And with me on her back, Saphira won't be able to cover the distance as quickly.
No, I won't,
Saphira said to him.
Aragorn continued, Even under the best of circumstances, it would still take us a week to reach you at Feinster, and that would be without staying for more than a minute in Ellesmere.
An expression of profound exhaustion crossed Nasawada's face.
Must you fly all the way to Ellesmere? Wouldn't it be sufficient to scry with your mentors once you are past the wards along the edge of Dueldenvarden? The time you would save could be crucial.
I don't know. We can try. Nasawada closed her eyes for a moment. In a hoarse voice, she said,
I may be able to delay our arrival at Feinster for 4 days. Go to Ellesmere or don't, I leave the decision up to you. If you do, then stay however long is needed.
You're right. Unless you find a way to defeat Galbatorix, we have no hope of victory.
Even so, keep you in mind the tremendous risk we are taking, the lives of the Varden I will be sacrificing in order to buy you this time. And how many more of the Varden will die if we lay siege to Feinster without you?
Somber, Aragorn nodded.
I won't forget. I should hope not. Now go. Do not tarry any longer. Fly, fly. Fly faster than a diving hawk, Saphira. And do not let anything slow you.
Nasawada touched the tips of her fingers to her lips, and then pressed them against the invisible surface of the mirror, where he knew she beheld the moving likeness of him and Saphira.
Luck on your journey, Aragorn, Saphira. If we meet again, I fear it will be on the field of battle.
And then she hurried from their sight, and Aragorn released his spell, and the water in the basin cleared. The Whipping Post. Roran sat bolt upright and stared past Nasawada, his eyes fixed upon a wrinkle in the side of the Crimson Pavilion. He could feel Nasawada studying him, but he refused to meet her gaze. During the long, dull silence that enveloped them, he contemplated a host of dire possibilities, and his temples throbbed with a feverish intensity. He wished he could leave the stifling pavilion and breathed the cool air outside. At last, Nasawada said,
What am I going to do with you, Roran?
He straightened his spine even more. Whatever you wish, my lady.
An admirable answer, Stronghammer, but in no way does it resolve my quandary.
Nasawada sipped wine from a goblet.
Twice you defied a direct order from Captain Edric, and yet if you hadn't, neither he nor you nor the rest of your band might have survived to tell the tale. However, your success does not negate the reality of your disobedience. By your own account, you knowingly committed insubordination, and I must punish you, if I am to maintain discipline among the Varden.
Yes, my lady. Her brow darkened.
Blast it, Stronghammer! If you were anyone else but Aragorn's cousin, and if your gambit had been even one whit less effective, I would have you strung up and hanged for your misconduct.
Roran swallowed as he imagined a noose tightening around his neck. With the middle finger of her right hand, Nasuada tapped the arm of her high-backed chair with increasing speed, until, stopping, she said,
"Do you wish to continue fighting with the Varden, Roran?"
"Yes, my lady," he replied without hesitation.
"What are you willing to endure in order to remain within my army?"
Roran did not allow himself to dwell upon the implications of her question. "Whatever I must, my lady." The tension in her face eased, and Nasuada nodded, appearing satisfied.
"I hoped you would say that. Tradition and established precedent leave me only three choices. One, I can hang you, but I won't, for a multitude of reasons. Two, I can give you 30 lashes and then discharge you from the ranks of the Varden. Or three, I can give you 50 lashes and keep you under my command."
50 lashes isn't that many more than 30, Roran thought, trying to bolster his courage. He wet his lips. "Would I be flogged where all could see?" Nasuada's eyebrows rose a fraction of an inch.
"Your pride has no part in this, Stronghammer. The punishment must be severe, so that others are not tempted to follow in your footsteps, and it must be held in public, so that the whole of the Varden can profit by it. If you are even half as intelligent as you seem, you knew when you defied Edric that your decision would have consequences, and that those consequences would most likely be unpleasant. The choice you must now make is simple. Will you stay with the Varden, or will you abandon your friends and family and go your own way?"
Roran lifted his chin, angry that she would question his word. "I shall not leave, Lady Nasuada. No matter how many lashes you assign me, they cannot be as painful as losing my home and my father was."
"No," said Nasuada softly, "they could not. One of the magicians of Duvrangar Gata will oversee the flogging and attend to you afterward, to ensure that the whip causes you no permanent damage. However, they shall not entirely heal your wounds, nor may you seek out a magician on your own to mend your back."
"I understand."
"Your flogging will be held as soon as Jormungandr can marshal the troops. Until then, you will remain under guard in a tent by the whipping post."
It relieved Roran that he would not have to wait any longer. He did not want to have to labor for days under the shadow of what lay before him. "My lady," he said, and she dismissed him with a motion of her finger. Turning on his heel, Roran marched out of the pavilion. Two guards took up positions on either side of him as he emerged. Without looking at or speaking to him, they led Roran through the camp until they arrived at a small, empty tent, not far from the blackened whipping post, which stood upon a slight rise just beyond the edge of the camp. The post was 6.5 feet high, and had a thick crossbeam near the top, to which prisoners' wrists were tied. Rows of scratches from the fingernails of scourged men covered the crossbeam. Roran forced himself to look away, and then ducked inside the tent. The only piece of furniture inside was a battered wooden stool. He sat and concentrated upon his breathing, determined to remain calm. As the minutes passed, Roran began to hear the tromp of boots and the clink of mail as the Varden assembled around the whipping post. Roran imagined the thousands of men and women staring at him, including the villagers from Carverhall. His pulse quickened and sweat sprang up upon his brow. After about half an hour, the sorceress Triana entered the tent and had him stripped down to his trousers, which embarrassed Roran, although the woman seemed to take no notice. Triana examined him all over and even cast an additional spell of healing on his left shoulder, but a soldier had stabbed him with the bolt of a crossbow. Then she declared him fit to continue and gave him a shirt made of sackcloth to wear in place of his own. Roran had just pulled a shirt over his head when Katrina pushed her way into the tent. As he beheld her, an equal measure of joy and dread filled Roran. Katrina glanced between him and Triana then curtsied to the sorceress.
May I please speak with my husband alone?
Of course. I shall wait outside.
Once Triana had departed, Katrina rushed to Roran and threw her arms around him. He hugged her just as fiercely as she hugged him, for he had not seen her since he had returned to the Varden.
Oh, how I've missed you,
Katrina whispered in his right ear.
And I you, he murmured.
They drew apart just far enough so that they could gaze into each other's eyes, and then Katrina scowled.
This is wrong. I went to Nasuada and I begged her to pardon you, or at least to reduce the number of lashes, but she refused to grant my request.
Running his hands up and down Katrina's back, Roran said,
I wish that you hadn't.
Why not?
Because I said that I would remain with the Varden, and I will not go back on my word.
But this is wrong,
said Katrina, gripping him by his shoulders.
Khan told me what you did, Roran. You slew almost 200 soldiers by yourself, and if not for your heroism, none of the men with you would have survived. Nasuada ought to be plying you with gifts and praise, not having you whipped like a common criminal.
It does not matter whether this is right or wrong, he told her. It is necessary. If I were in Nasuada's position, I would have given the same order myself.
Katrina shuddered.
50 lashes, though. Why does it have to be so many? Men have died from being whipped that many times.
Only if they had weak hearts. Don't be so worried. It will take more than that to kill me.
A false smile flickered across Katrina's lips, and then a sob escaped her, and she pressed her face against his chest. He cradled her in his arms, stroking her hair and reassuring her as best he could, even though he felt no better than she. After several minutes, Roran heard a horn being winded outside the tent, and he knew that their time together was drawing to a close. Extricating himself from Katrina's embrace, he said,
There is something I want you to do for me.
What?
She asked, dabbing at her eyes.
Go back to our tent and do not leave it until after my flogging.
Katrina appeared shocked by his request.
No, I shall not leave you, not now.
Please, he said, you should not have to see this.
And you should not have to endure it, she retorted.
Leave that. I know you wish to stay by my side, but I can bear this better if I know that you aren't here watching me. I brought this upon myself, Katrina, and I do not want you to suffer because of it as well.
Her expression became strained.
The knowledge of your fate shall pain me regardless of where I am standing. However, I shall do as you ask, but only because it will help you through this ordeal. You know that I would have the whip fall upon my own body instead of yours if I could.
And you know, he said, kissing her on both cheeks, that I would refuse to let you take my place.
Tears welled up in her eyes again, and she pulled him closer, hugging him so tightly he had difficulty breathing. They were still wrapped in each other's arms when the entrance flap to the tent was swept back, and Jormunda entered, along with two of the Nighthawks. Katrina disengaged herself from Roran, curtsied to Jormunda, and then, without a word, slipped out of the tent. Jormunda extended a hand toward Roran.
It's time.
Nodding, Roran rose and allowed Jormunda and the guards to escort him to the whipping post outside. Row after row of the Varden boxed in the area around the post, every man, woman, dwarf, and Urgle standing with stiff spines and squared shoulders. After his initial glimpse of the assembled army, Roran gazed off toward the horizon and did his best to ignore the onlookers. The two guards lifted Roran's arms above his head and secured his wrists to the crossbeam of the whipping post. While they did, Jormunda walked around in front of the post and held up a leather-wrapped dowel.
Here, bite down on this, he said in a low voice. It will keep you from hurting yourself.
Grateful, Roran opened his mouth and allowed Jormunda to fit the dowel between his teeth. The tanned leather tasted bitter, like green acorns.
Then a horn and a drum roll sounded,
and Jormunda read out the charges against Roran, and the guards cut off Roran's sackcloth shirt. He shivered as the cold air washed across his bare torso. An instant before it struck, Roran heard the whip whistling through the air. It felt as if a rod of hot metal had been laid across his flesh. Roran arched his back and bit down on the dowel. An involuntary groan escaped him, although the dowel muffled the sound, so he thought no one else heard. "One," said the man wielding the whip. The shock of the second blow caused Roran to groan again, but thereafter he remained silent, determined not to appear weak before the whole of the Varden. The whipping was as painful as any of the numerous wounds Roran had suffered over the past few months, but after a dozen or so blows, he gave up trying to fight the pain, and surrendering to it, entered a bleary trance. His field of vision narrowed until the only thing he saw was the worn wood in front of him. At times his sight flickered and went blank as he drifted into brief spates of unconsciousness. After an interminable time, he heard the dim and faraway voice intone, 30! And despair gripped him as he wondered, how can I possibly withstand another 20 lashes? Then he thought of Katrina and their unborn child, and the thought gave him strength. Roran woke, to find himself lying on his stomach on the cot inside the tent he and Katrina shared. Katrina was kneeling next to him, stroking his hair and murmuring in his ear, while someone daubed a cold, sticky substance over the stripes on his back. He winced and stiffened as the anonymous person poked a particularly sensitive spot. "That is not how I would treat a patient of mine," he heard Triana say in a haughty tone. "If you treat all of your patients as you were treating Roran," another woman replied, "I am amazed that any survived your attentions." After a moment, Roran recognized the second voice as belonging to the strange, bright-eyed herbalist, Angela. "I beg your pardon," said Triana. "I will not stand here and be insulted by a lowly fortune-teller who struggles to cast even the most basic spell." "Sit then, if it pleases you. But whether you sit or stand, I will continue to insult you until you admit that his back muscle attaches here and not there." Roran felt a finger touch him in two different places, each a half inch apart. "Oh," said Triana, and left the tent. Katrina smiled at Roran, and for the first time he noticed the tears streaking her face.
"Roran, do you understand me?" she asked. "Are you awake?"
I think so," he said, his voice raspy. His jaw ached from biting the dowel so hard for so long. He coughed, then grimaced as every one of the 50 stripes on his back throbbed in unison.
"There we go," said Angela. "All finished." "It's amazing. I didn't expect you and Triana to do so much," said Katrina. "On Nasawada's orders." "Nasawada? Why would—" "You'll have to ask her yourself. Tell him to stay off his back if he can help it. And he ought to be careful twisting from side to side, or he might tear open the scabs."
"Thank you,"
Roran mumbled. Behind him, Angela laughed.
"Think nothing of it, Roran. Or rather, think something of it, but do not consider it overly important. Besides, it amuses me to have tended injuries on both your back and Aragon's. Right then, I'll be off. Watch out for ferrets."
When the herbalist had gone, Roran closed his eyes again. Katrina's smooth fingers stroked his forehead.
"You were very brave," she said.
"Was I?"
"Aye. Jormunda and everyone else I spoke to said that you never cried out or begged for the flogging to stop."
"Good."
He wanted to know how serious his wounds were, but he was reluctant to force her to describe the damage to his back. Katrina seemed to sense his desire, however, for she said,
"Angela believes that with a bit of luck, you won't scar too badly. In either case, once you're completely healed,
Eragon or another magician can remove the scars from your back, and it will be as if you were never whipped in the first place.
Would you like something to drink? She asked.
I have a pot of yarrow tea steeping.
Yes, please.
As Katrina rose, Roran heard another person enter the tent. He opened one eye and was surprised to see Nasawada standing next to the pole at the front of the tent.
My lady, Katrina said, her voice razor sharp.
In spite of the lances of pain from his back, Roran pushed himself partially up, and with Katrina's help swung himself into a sitting position. Leaning on Katrina, he started to stand, but Nasawada lifted a hand.
Please don't. I do not wish to cause you any more distress than I already have.
Why have you come, Lady Nasawada? Asked Katrina. Roran needs to rest and recover, not to spend his time talking when he does not have to.
Roran placed a hand on Katrina's left shoulder.
I can talk if I must, he said.
Moving farther into the tent, Nasawada lifted the hem of her green dress and sat on the small chest of belongings Katrina had brought with her from Carvajal. After arranging the folds of her skirt, she said,
I have another mission for you, Roran. A small raid similar to those you have already participated in.
When will I leave?
He asked, puzzled that she would bother to inform him in person of such a simple assignment.
Tomorrow.
Katrina's eyes widened.
Are you mad?
She exclaimed.
Katrina,
Roran murmured, attempting to placate her. But she shrugged off his hand and said,
The last trip you sent him on nearly killed him, and you've just had him whipped within an inch of his life. You can't order him back into combat so soon. He wouldn't last more than a minute against Galbatorix's soldiers.
I can, and I must,
said Nasawada with such authority Katrina held her tongue and waited to hear Nasawada's explanation, although Roran could tell that her anger had not subsided. Gazing at him intensely, Nasawada said,
Roran, as you may or may not be aware, our alliance with the Urgals is upon the verge of collapse. One of our own murdered three of the Urgals while you were serving under Captain Edric, who, you may be pleased to know, is a captain no more. Anyway, I had the miserable wretch who killed the Urgals hanged, but ever since, our relations with Garshvarg's rams have become increasingly precarious.
What does this have to do with Roran?
Katrina demanded. Nasawada pressed her lips together, then said,
I need to convince the Varden to accept the presence of the Urgals without further bloodshed. And the best way I can do that is to show the Varden that our two races can work together in peaceful pursuit of a common goal. Toward that end, the group you shall be travelling with will contain equal numbers of both humans and Urgals.
But that still doesn't...
Katrina started to say.
And I'm placing the whole lot of them under your command, Stronghammer.
Me?
Roran rasped, astonished.
Why?
With a wry smile, Nasawada said,
Because you will do whatever you have to in order to protect your friends and family. In this you are like me, although my family is larger than yours, for I consider the whole of the Varden my kin. Also, because you are Eragon's cousin, I cannot afford to have you commit insubordination again, for then I will have no choice but to execute you or expel you from the Varden, neither of which I wish to do. Therefore I am giving you your own command, so that there is no one above you to disobey, except me. If you ignore my orders, it had better be to kill Galbatorix. No other reason will save you from far worse than the lashes you earn today. And I'm giving you this command, because you have proven that you are able to convince others to follow you, even in the face of the most daunting circumstances. You have as good a chance as any of maintaining control over a group of Urgals and humans. I would send Eragon if I could, but since he is not here, the responsibility falls to you. When the Varden hear that Eragon's own cousin, Roran Stronghammer, he who slew nigh on 200 soldiers by himself, went on a mission with Urgals, and that the mission was a success, then we may yet keep the Urgals as our allies for the duration of this war. That is why I had Angela and Triana heal you more than is customary, not to spare you your punishment, but because I need you fit to command. Now what say you, Stronghammer? Can I count on you?"
Roran looked at Katrina. He knew she desperately wished he would tell Nasawada that he was incapable of leading the raid. Dropping his gaze so he did not have to see her distress, Roran thought of the immense size of the army that opposed the Varden, and then in a hoarse whisper he said,
"You may count on me, Lady Nasawada."
Among the Clouds. From Trondheim, Saphira flew the 5 miles to Farthen Dûr's inner wall. Then she and Aragorn entered the tunnel that burrowed east, miles through Farthen Dûr's base. Aragorn could have run the length of the tunnel in about 10 minutes, but since the height of the ceiling prevented Saphira from flying or jumping, she would not have been able to keep up. So he limited himself to a brisk walk. An hour later, they emerged in Odred Valley, which ran north to south. Nestled among the foothills at the head of the narrow, fern-filled valley was Fëanor's Mirna, a fair-sized lake that was like a drop of dark ink between the towering mountains of the Beor Range. From the northern end of Fëanor's Mirna flowed the Ragni Darman, which wound its way up the valley until it joined with the Aj Ragni by the flanks of Moldún the Proud, the northernmost mountain of the Beors. They had departed Trondheim well before dawn, and although the tunnel had slowed them, it was still early morning. The ragged strip of sky overhead was barred with rays of pale yellow, where sunlight streamed between the peaks of the towering mountains. Within the valley below, ridges of heavy clouds clung to the sides of the mountains like vast grey snakes. Coils of white mist drifted up from the glassy surface of the lake. Aragorn and Saphira stopped at the edge of Fëanor's Mirna to drink and to replenish their waterskins for the next leg of their journey. The water came from melted snow and ice high in the mountains. It was so cold it made Aragorn's teeth hurt. He screwed up his eyes and stamped the ground, groaning as a spike of cold-induced pain shot through his skull. As the throbbing subsided, he gazed across the lake. Between the curtains of shifting mist, he spotted the ruins of a sprawling castle, built upon a bare stone spur on one mountain. Thick ropes of ivy strangled the crumbling walls, but aside from that, the structure appeared lifeless. Aragorn shivered. The abandoned building seemed gloomy, ominous, as if it were the decaying carcass of some foul beast.
"Ready?"
Saphira asked.
"Ready,"
he said, and climbed into the saddle. From Fëanor's Mirna, Saphira flew northward, following Odred Valley out of the Beor Mountains. The valley did not lead directly toward Ellesmere, which was farther west, yet they had no choice but to remain in the valley, as the passes between the mountains were over 5 miles high. Saphira flew at as lofty an altitude as Aragorn could endure, because it was easier for her to traverse long distances in the rarefied upper atmosphere than in the thick, moist air near the ground. Aragorn protected himself against the freezing temperatures by wearing several layers of clothes and by shielding himself from the wind with a spell that split the stream of freezing air so it flowed harmlessly to either side. Riding Saphira was far from restful, but since she flapped in a slow and steady rhythm, Aragorn did not have to concentrate upon maintaining his balance, as he did when she turned or dove or engaged in other more elaborate manoeuvres. For the most part, he divided his time between talking with Saphira, thinking back upon the events of the past few weeks, and studying the ever-changing vista below them.
"You used magic without the ancient language when the dwarves attacked you,"
said Saphira.
"That was a dangerous thing to do."
"I know, but I didn't have time to think of the words. Besides, you never use the ancient language when you cast a spell."
"That's different. I'm a dragon. We do not need the ancient language to state our intentions. We know what we want, and we do not change our minds as easily as elves or humans."
The orange sun was a hand's breadth above the horizon when Sephira sailed through the mouth of the valley and out over the flat, empty grasslands that abutted the Beor Mountains. Straightening in the saddle, Aragorn gazed around them and shook his head, amazed by how much distance they had covered. "If only we could have flown to Ellesmere the first time," he said. "We would have had so much more time to spend with Oromis and Gleda."
Sephira indicated her agreement with a silent mental nod. Sephira flew until the sun had set and the stars covered the sky, and the mountains were a dark purple smudge behind them. She would have continued on until morning, but Aragorn insisted they stop to rest.
"You are still tired from your trip to Farthendur. We can fly through the night tomorrow, and the day after as well if necessary, but tonight you must sleep."
Although Sephira did not like his proposal, she agreed to it, and landed by a patch of willow trees growing alongside a stream. As he dismounted, Aragorn discovered his legs were so stiff he had difficulty remaining on his feet. He unsaddled Sephira, then spread his bedroll on the ground next to her, and curled up with his back against her warm body. He had no need of a tent, for she sheltered him with a wing, like a mother hawk protecting her brood. The two of them soon sank into their respective dreams, which mingled in strange and wonderful ways, for their minds remained linked even then. As soon as the first hint of light appeared in the east, Aragorn and Sephira continued on their way, soaring high above the verdant plains. A fierce headwind sprang up in mid-morning, which slowed Sephira to half her normal speed. Try as she might, she could not rise above the wind. All day she fought against the rushing air. It was arduous work, and although Aragorn gave her as much of his strength as he dared, by afternoon her exhaustion was profound. She swooped down and alighted on a knoll in the grasslands, and sat there with her wings draped across the ground, panting and trembling.
"We should stay here for the night," Aragorn said.
"No."
"Sephira, you're in no condition to go on. Let's make camp until you recover. Who knows, the wind might die down by evening."
He heard the wet rasp of her tongue as she licked her chops, and then the heave of her lungs as she resumed panting.
"No,"
she said.
"On these plains, it might blow for weeks or even months on end. We cannot wait for calm."
"But..."
"I will not give up merely because I hurt Aragorn. Too much is at stake."
"Then let me give you energy from Arryn. There is more than enough in the ring to sustain you from here to Dúvaldinvarden."
"No,"
she repeated again.
"Save Arryn for when we have no other recourse. I can rest and recover in the forest. Arryn, however, we may have need of at any moment. You should not deplete it merely to ease my discomfort."
"I hate to see you in such pain, though."
A faint growl escaped her.
"My ancestors, the wild dragons, would not have shrunk from a puny breeze like this, and neither will I."
And with that, she jumped back into the air, carrying him with her as she drove herself into the gale. As the day was drawing to an end and the wind still howled around them, pushing against Sephira as if fate were determined to keep them from reaching Dúvaldinvarden, Aragorn thought of the dwarf woman Glumra and of her faith in the dwarven gods. And for the first time in his life, he felt the desire to pray. Withdrawing from his mental contact with Sephira, who was so tired and preoccupied she did not notice, Aragorn whispered,
"Gunterra, king of the gods, if you exist, and if you can hear me, and if you have the power, then please still this wind. I know I'm not a dwarf, but King Hrothgar adopted me into his clan, and I think that gives me the right to pray to you. Gunterra, please, we have to get to Dúvaldinvarden as fast as possible, not only for the good of the Varden, but also for the good of your people, the Nerlin. Please, I beg of you, still this wind. Sephira cannot keep this up much longer."
Then, feeling slightly foolish,
Aragorn extended himself towards Saphira's consciousness, wincing in sympathy as he felt the burning within her muscles. Late that night, when all was cold and black, the wind abated, and thereafter only occasionally buffeted them with a gust. When morning came, Aragorn looked down and saw the hard, dry land of the Haderach Desert.
"Blast it," he said,
for they had not come as far as he had hoped.
"We won't make it to Ellesmere today, will we?"
"Not unless the wind decides to blow in the opposite direction and carry us there upon its back."
Saphira laboured in silence for another few minutes, then added,
"However, barring any other unpleasant surprises, we should arrive at Duweldenwarden by evening."
Aragorn grunted. They landed only twice that day. Once, while they were on the ground, Saphira devoured a brace of ducks that she caught and killed with a burst of fire. But other than that, she went without food. To save time, Aragorn ate his own meals in the saddle. As Saphira had predicted, Duweldenwarden came into sight even as the sun neared setting. The forest appeared before them as an endless expanse of green. Deciduous trees, oaks and beeches and maples, dominated the outer parts of the forest, but farther in, Aragorn knew, they gave way to the forbidding pine trees that formed the bulk of the woods. Dusk had settled over the countryside by the time they arrived at the edge of Duweldenwarden, and Saphira glided to a soft landing under the outstretched branches of a massive oak. She folded her wings and sat still for a while, too tired to continue. Her crimson tongue hung loose from her mouth. While she rested, Aragorn listened to the rustle of leaves overhead, and to the hoot of owls and the chirp of evening insects. When she was sufficiently recovered, Saphira walked forward and passed between two giant moss-covered oak trees, and so crossed into Duweldenwarden on foot. The elves had made it impossible for anyone or anything to enter the forest by means of magic. And since dragons did not rely upon their bodies alone to fly, Saphira could not enter while in the air, else her wings would fail her, and she would fall from the sky.
"That should be far enough,"
Saphira said, stopping in a small meadow several hundred feet from the perimeter of the forest. Aragorn unbuckled the straps from around his legs and slid down Saphira's side. He searched the meadow until he found a bare patch of earth. With his hands, he scooped out a shallow hole a foot and a half wide. He summoned forth water to fill the hole, then uttered a spell of scrying. The water shimmered and acquired a soft yellow glow as Aragorn beheld the interior of Oromis's hut. The silver-haired elf was sitting at his kitchen table, reading a tattered scroll. Oromis looked up at Aragorn and nodded with unsurprised recognition.
"Master,"
Aragorn said, and twisted his hand over his chest.
"Greetings, Aragorn. I have been expecting you. Where are you?"
"Saphira and I just reached Duweldenwarden. Master, I know we promised to return to Ellesmere, but the Varden are only a few days away from the city of Feinster, and they are vulnerable without us. We don't have the time to fly all the way to Ellesmere. Could you answer our questions here? Through the scrying pool?"
Oromis leaned back in his chair, his angled face grave and pensive. Then he said,
"I will not instruct you at a distance, Aragorn. I can guess at some of the things you wish to ask me, and they are subjects we must discuss in person."
"Master, please, if Murtagh and Thorn—"
"No, Aragorn. I understand the reason for your urgency, but your studies are just as important as protecting the Varden, maybe even more so. We must do this properly, or not at all."
Aragorn sighed and slumped forward. "Yes, Master."
Oromis nodded.
"Glader and I will be waiting for you. Fly safe and fly fast. We have much to talk about."
"Yes, Master."
Feeling numb and worn out, Aragorn ended the spell. The water soaked back into the ground. He held his head in his hands, staring at the patch of moist dirt between his feet. Saphira's heavy breathing was loud beside him.
"I guess we have to keep going," he said. "I'm sorry."
Her breathing paused for a moment as she licked her chops.
"It's all right. I'm not about to collapse."
He looked up at her.
"Are you sure?"
"Yes."
Aragorn reluctantly hoisted himself upright and climbed onto her back. "As long as we're going to Ellesmere," he said, tightening the straps around his legs,
"we should visit the Manoa tree again. Maybe we can finally figure out what Solombum meant. I could certainly use a new sword."
When Aragorn had first met Solombum in Tirm, the Weircat had told him,
"When the time comes and you need a weapon, look under the roots of the Manoa tree. Then, when all seems lost and your power is insufficient, go to the Rock of Cuthien and speak your name to open the Vault of Souls."
Aragorn still did not know where the Rock of Cuthien was, but during their first stay in Ellesmere, he and Saphira had had several chances to examine the Manoa tree. They had discovered no clue as to the exact whereabouts of the supposed weapon. Moss, dirt, bark, and the occasional ant were the only things they had seen among the roots of the Manoa tree, and none of them indicated where to excavate.
"Solombum might not have meant a sword,"
Saphira pointed out.
"Weircats love riddles nearly as much as dragons do. Even if it exists, this weapon might be a scrap of parchment with a spell inscribed on it, or a book or a painting, or a sharp piece of rock, or any other dangerous thing."
"Whatever it is, I hope we can find it. Who knows when we will have the chance to return to Ellesmere again?"
Saphira raked aside a fallen tree that lay before her, then crouched and unfurled her velvety wings, her massive shoulder muscles bunching. Aragorn yelped and grabbed the front of his saddle as she surged up and forward with unexpected force, rising above the tops of the trees in a single vertiginous bound. Wheeling over the sea of shifting branches, Saphira oriented herself in a northwesterly direction, and then set out toward the elves' capital, the beats of her wings slow and heavy.
Butting Heads. The raid on the supply train went almost exactly as Roran had planned. 3 days after leaving the main body of the Varden, he and his fellow horsemen rode down from the lip of a ravine and struck the meandering line of wagons broadside. Meanwhile, the Urgals sprang out from behind boulders scattered across the floor of the ravine and attacked the supply train from the front, stopping the procession in its tracks. The soldiers and wagoners put up a brave fight, but the ambush had caught them while sleepy and disorganized, and Roran's force soon overwhelmed them. None of the humans or Urgals died in the attack, and only 3 suffered wounds, 2 humans and 1 Urgal. Roran killed several of the soldiers himself, but for the most part he hung back and concentrated upon directing the assault, as was his responsibility now. He was still stiff and sore from the flogging he had endured, and he did not want to exert himself any more than necessary for fear of cracking the mat of scabs that covered his back. Until that point, Roran had had no difficulty maintaining discipline among the 20 humans and 20 Urgals. Although it was obvious that neither group liked nor trusted the other, an attitude he shared, for he regarded the Urgals with the same degree of suspicion and distaste as would any man who had been raised in proximity to the spine, they had succeeded in working together during the past 3 days with nary a raised voice. That both groups had managed to cooperate so well had, he knew, little to do with his prowess as a commander. Nasuwada and Nargajvarg had taken great care in picking the warriors who were to travel with him, selecting only those with a reputation for a quick blade, sound judgment, and above all, a calm and even disposition. However, in the aftermath of the attack on the supply train, as his men were busy dragging the bodies of the soldiers and the wagoners into a pile, and Roran was riding up and down the line of wagons overseeing the work,
he heard an agonized howl from somewhere by the far end of the train. Thinking that perhaps another contingent of soldiers had chanced upon them, Roran shouted to Khan and several other men to join him, and then touched his spurs to Snowfire's flanks and galloped toward the rear of the wagons. Four Urghuls had tied an enemy soldier to the trunk of a gnarled willow tree, and were amusing themselves by poking and prodding him with their swords. Swearing, Roran jumped down from Snowfire, and with a single blow of his hammer put the man out of his misery. A swirling cloud of dust swept over the group as Khan and four other warriors galloped up to the willow tree. They reined in their steeds and spread out on either side of Roran, holding their weapons at the ready. The largest Urghul, a ram named Yarbog, stepped forward.
"Strong hammer, why did you stop our sport? It would have danced for us for many more minutes."
From between clenched teeth, Roran said, "So long as you are under my command, you will not torture captives without cause. Am I understood? Many of these soldiers have been forced to serve Galbatorix against their will. Many of them are our friends, or family, or neighbors. And while we must fight them, I will not have you treat them with unnecessary cruelty. If not for the whims of fate, any one of us humans might be standing in their place. They are not our enemy. Galbatorix is, as he is yours." The Urghul's heavy brow beetled, nearly obscuring his deep-set yellow eyes.
"But you will still kill them, yes? Why cannot we enjoy seeing them wriggle and dance first?"
Roran wondered if the Urghul's skull was too thick to crack with his hammer. Struggling to restrain his anger, he said, "Because it is wrong, if nothing else." Pointing at the dead soldier, he said, "What if he had been one of your own race, who had been enthralled by the Shade Durza? Would you have tormented him as well?"
"Of course," said Yarbog. "They would want us to tickle them with our swords, so that they would have an opportunity to prove their bravery before they died. Is it not the same with you hornless humans, or have you no stomach for pain?"
Roran was not sure how serious an insult it was among the Urghuls to call another hornless. But even so, he had no doubt that questioning someone's courage was as offensive to Urghuls as it was to humans, if not more so. "Any one of us could withstand more pain without crying out than you, Yarbog," he said, tightening his grip on his hammer and shield. "Now, unless you wish to experience agony the likes of which you cannot imagine, surrender your sword to me. Then untie that poor wretch and carry him over to the rest of the bodies. After that, go see to the pack horses. They are yours to care for until we return to the Varden." Without waiting for an acknowledgement from the Urghul, Roran turned and grasped Snowfire's reins and prepared to climb back onto the stallion.
"No,"
growled Yarbog. Roran froze with one foot in a stirrup and silently swore to himself. He had hoped that just such a situation would not arise during the trip. Swinging around, he said, "No. Are you refusing to obey my orders?" Drawing back his lips to expose his short fangs, Yarbog said,
"No. I challenge you for leadership of this tribe, Stronghammer."
And the Urghul threw back his massive head and bellowed so loudly that the rest of the humans and Urghuls stopped what they were doing and ran toward the willow tree, until all 40 of them were clustered around Yarbog and Roran.
"Shall we attend to this creature for you?" Khan asked, his voice ringing out.
Wishing that there were not so many onlookers, Roran shook his head. "No, I shall deal with him myself." Despite his words, he was glad to have his men beside him, opposite the line of hulking, grey-skinned Urghuls. The humans were smaller than the Urghuls, but all except Roran were mounted on horses, which would give them a slight advantage if there were a fight between the two groups. If that came to pass, Karn's magic would be of little help, for the Urghuls had a spellcaster of their own, a shaman named Dajgra, and from what Roran had seen, Dajgra was the more powerful magician, if not as skilled in the nuances of their arcane art. To Yarbog, Roran said, "It is not the custom of the Varden to award leadership based upon trial by combat. If you wish to fight, I will fight, but you will gain nothing by it. If I lose, Khan will assume my command, and you will answer to him instead of me."
"Baal," said Yarbog, "I do not challenge you for the right to lead your own race. I challenge you for the right to lead us, the fighting rams of the Bolvec tribe. You have not proven yourself, Stronghammer, so you cannot claim the position of chieftain. If you lose, I will become chieftain here, and we shall not lift our chins to you, Khan, or any other creature too weak to earn our respect."
Roran pondered his situation before accepting the inevitable. Even if it cost him his life, he had to try to maintain his authority over the Urgals, else the Varden would lose them as allies. Taking a breath, he said, "Among my race, it is customary for the person who has been challenged to choose the time and place for the fight, as well as the weapons both parties will use." Chortling deep in his throat, Yarbog said,
"The time is now, Stronghammer. The place is here, and among my race, we fight in a loincloth and without weapons."
"That is hardly fair, since I have no horns," Roran pointed out. "Will you agree to let me use my hammer to compensate for my lack?" Yarbog thought about it, then said,
"You may keep your helmet and shield, but no hammer. Weapons are not allowed when we fight to be chief."
"I see. Well, if I can't have my hammer, I will forego my helmet and shield as well. What are the rules of combat? And how shall we decide the winner?"
"There is only one rule, Stronghammer. If you flee, you forfeit the match and are banished from your tribe. You win by forcing your rival to submit, but since I will never submit, we will fight to the death."
Roran nodded. "That might be what he intends to do, but I won't kill him if I can help it." "Let us begin," he cried, and banged his hammer against his shield. At his direction, the men and Urgals cleared a space in the middle of the ravine, and pegged out a square 12 paces by 12 paces. Then Roran and Yarbog stripped, and two Urgals slathered bear grease over Yarbog's body, while Karn and Loftan, another human, did the same for Roran. "Rub as much as you can into my back," Roran murmured. He wanted his scabs to be as soft as possible, so as to minimize the number of places they would crack. Leaning close to him, Karn said, "Why did you refuse the shield and helmet?" "They would only slow me. I'll have to be as fast as a frightened hare if I'm to avoid being crushed by him." As Khan and Loftan worked their way down his limbs, Roran studied his opponent, searching for any vulnerability that would help him defeat the Urgal. Yarbog stood well over 6 feet tall. His back was broad, his chest deep, and his arms and legs covered with knotted muscles. His neck was as thick as a bull's, as it had to be, in order to sustain the weight of his head and its curled horns. 3 slanting scars marked the left side of his waist, where he had been clawed by an animal. Sparse black bristles grew over the whole of his hide. "At least he's not a cull," thought Roran. He was confident of his own strength, but even so he did not believe that he could overpower Yarbog with sheer force. Rare was the man who could hope to match the physical prowess of a healthy Urgal ram. Also, Roran knew that Yarbog's large black fingernails, his fangs, his horns, and his leathery hide would all provide Yarbog with considerable advantages in the unarmed combat they were about to engage in. "If I can, I will," Roran decided, thinking of all the low tricks he could use against the Urgal. For fighting Yarbog would not be like wrestling with Aragorn or Baldur or any other man from Carvajal. Rather, Roran was sure that it would be like the ferocious and unrestrained brawling between 2 wild beasts. Again and again Roran's eyes returned to Yarbog's immense horns, for those he knew were the most dangerous of the Urgal's features. With them, Yarbog could butt and gore Roran with impunity, and they would also protect the sides of Yarbog's head from any blows Roran could deliver with his bare hands, although they limited the Urgal's peripheral vision. Then it occurred to Roran that just as the horns were Yarbog's greatest natural gift, so too they might be his undoing. Roran rolled his shoulders and bounced on the balls of his feet, eager for the contest to be over. When both Roran and Yarbog were completely covered with bear grease, their seconds retreated, and they stepped into the confines of the square pegged out on the ground. Roran kept his knees partially flexed, ready to leap in any direction at the slightest hint of movement from Yarbog. The rocky soil was cold, hard, and rough beneath the soles of his bare feet. A slight gust stirred the branches of the nearby willow tree. One of the oxen, harnessed to the wagons, pawed at a clump of grass, his tack creaking. With a rippling bellow, Yarbog charged Roran, covering the distance between them with three thundering steps. Roran waited until Yarbog was nearly upon him, then jumped to the right. He underestimated Yarbog's speed, however. Lowering his head, the Urgal rammed his horns into Roran's left shoulder and tossed him sprawling across the square. Sharp rocks poked into Roran's side as he landed. Lines of pain flashed across his back, tracing the paths of his half-healed wounds. He grunted and rolled upright, feeling several scabs break open, exposing his raw flesh to the stinging air. Dirt and small pebbles clung to the film of grease on his body. Keeping both feet on the ground, he shuffled toward Yarbog, never taking his eyes off the snarling Urgal. Again Yarbog charged him, and again Roran attempted to jump out of the way. This time his maneuver succeeded, and he slipped past the Urgal with inches to spare. Whirling around, Yarbog ran at him for a third time, and once more Roran managed to evade him. Then Yarbog changed tactics. Advancing sideways like a crab, he thrust out his large hooked hands to catch Roran and pull him into his deadly embrace. Roran flinched and retreated. Whatever happened, he had to avoid falling into Yarbog's clutches. With his immense strength, the Urgal could soon dispatch him. The men and Urgals gathered around the square were silent, their faces impassive as they watched Roran and Yarbog scuffle back and forth in the dirt. For several minutes, Roran and Yarbog exchanged quick, glancing blows. Roran avoided closing with the Urgal wherever possible, trying to wear him out from a distance. But as the fight dragged on, and Yarbog seemed no more tired than when they had begun, Roran realized that time was not his friend. If he was going to win, he had to end the fight without further delay. Hoping to provoke Yarbog into charging again, for his strategy depended upon just that, Roran withdrew to the far corner of the square and began to taunt him, saying, "Ha! You are as fat and slow as a milk cow! Can't you catch me, Yarbog? Or are your legs made of lard? You should cut off your horns in shame for letting a human make a fool of you. What will your prospective mates think when they hear of this? Will you tell them?" Yarbog drowned out Roran's words with a roar. The Urgal sprinted toward him, turning slightly so as to crash into Roran with his full weight. Skipping out of the way, Roran reached out for the tip of Yarbog's right horn, but missed his mark, and fell stumbling into the middle of the square, skinning both knees. He cursed to himself as he regained his footing. Checking his headlong rush just before momentum carried him beyond the boundaries of the square, Yarbog turned back, his small yellow eyes searching for Roran. "Yeah!" shouted Roran. He stuck out his tongue and made every rude gesture he could think of. "You couldn't hit a tree even if it was in front of you."
"Die, puny human!"
Yarbog growled and sprang at Roran, arms outstretched. Two of Yarbog's nails carved bloody furrows across Roran's ribs as Roran darted to his left. But he still managed to grasp and hang on to one of the Urgal's horns. Roran grabbed the other horn as well before Yarbog could throw him off. Using the horns as handles,
Roran wrenched Yarbog's head to one side and, straining every muscle, cast the Urgle to the ground. Roran's back flared in angry protest at the motion. As soon as Yarbog's chest touched the dirt, Roran